All right, so let's get started. The last time we finished the chapter on properties of conservation laws, which essentially culminated in this final theorem by Lux from 1957, in which he showed the existence of a solution to the general Riemann problem for a sort of generic conservation law, so system of conservation laws. And so we've seen essentially that the solution is of this type, as you can see here. So we have a nonlinear wave associated with each pair of eigenvectors and eigenvalues of the Jacobian of our conservation law, of our system of conservation law. And so they separate essentially these constant states in between. So we have our initial data UL on the left and our initial data UR on the right. And so in between, we have these intermediate states Z1, Z2, and so on. So M minus one of such states. This solution is by construction the entropy solution. So it's in this sense a unique solution, at least in 1D. It sort of satisfies the entropy condition by construction. We only allowed essentially the admissible parts of the shock sets of these so-called Hugoniot loci, and so on. So this is essentially how the general solution looks like. And so now let's sort of dive into a specific example to make things a little more concrete. So this is the very general abstract case. And so we already started talking about the Euler equations last time, and this is where I want to pick up the discussion again. Let's focus on the system of conservation laws of the Euler equations, where which are of this form. You've shown on the first problem set already that the Jacobian gives rise to these eigenvalues. So this is the bulk speed minus the sound speed, the bulk speed, and then the third eigenvalue is the bulk speed plus, so the fluid speed plus the sound speed. And so these are the associated eigenvectors, as you can convince yourself. So the little computation involved here. So on the current problem set, essentially you're going to show the following three properties, namely that the eigenvalue eigenvector pair associated with the first and the third eigenvalue are actually genuinely nonlinear fields, while the second eigenstate essentially is always a linearly degenerate state. And so these Euler equations also come with the following Riemann invariants. So one can show that this is again on the problem set that the entropy, the specific entropy, is a Riemann invariant. So it actually stays constant along some characteristics, and the K Riemann invariants here associated with the set of eigenvalues and eigenvectors are the following. So with the first one, lambda one, we have the entropy, and then u plus two times the sound speed over gamma minus one for an ideal gas equation of state. So for the second one, we have the fluid velocity u and also the pressure p. And actually, I forgot to list here the third one, which is analogous to the first one. There's just a minus sign involved here. So we have this setting. And from there, we can already deduce what the general situation is that we can expect for the solution to the Riemann problem. So,
sorry to interrupt, Daniel. Can I ask something?
Sure.
So, two eigenvalues, the one and the three, I recognize, right? I mean, those are sound waves propagating on the right or propagating on the right on the left.
Yeah. Right.
So what's the degree of freedom that we can, you know, that we can associate with lambda 2? Is there an interpretation? So that would be zero speed of propagation in the rest frame of the fluid.
Right. So what do you mean by degree of freedom? So this is essentially, so this is a contact discontinuity because it's linearly degenerate. And so this is also sometimes called an entropy wave because there's an entropy jump associated with that. But yeah, so this is, so that's always fixed. So what are you referring to as?
Well, I guess I was trying to interpret the eigenvalues as being signal speeds for something, mm-hmm. right? And for lambda one, lambda three, I can see that, you know, we're dealing with sound waves. Mm-hmm. I'm just wondering, you know, is there an interpretation like this for lambda two? Is there something that travels at zero speed in the fluid?
That's a good point. Yeah, so it's essentially this entropy wave. So there's sort of an entropy jump associated with that that essentially propagates at zero speed, if you want.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. So just knowing these sort of few facts here, and so this would be essentially the approach that you would take for any given system of conservation laws, right? You would first compute the eigenvalues, the eigenvectors. You would determine the nature of those eigenvalue and eigenvector pairs, so determine whether they are genuinely nonlinear or linearly degenerate. You would compute the Riemann invariance, which, as you'll see in a second, will help us a lot in constructing the actual solution in a given concrete example. And so then you would, from those facts, you would so first look at the general sort of layout of the solution, and then with the help of Riemann invariance, you can then construct the actual concrete solution. And so this is essentially the process that we will now go through. And although this is a specific example, some of this can actually be transferred to other problems and to completely other systems of equations as well. So from these facts here, we deduce the following. So again, if we look at the situation in state space, so now we have a three-dimensional state space due to the fact that we have three equations, right? So m equals three. And so our conservatives here, u1, u2, and u3, are density, momentum density, and total energy. And so if we pick, say, some state UL for our Riemann problem, and so we fix that and we specify some other UR not too far away so that we can expect a solution to exist according to Luck's theorem, then essentially the task is to combine, to link these two points by, okay, this looks a little too similar to the other one. Let me draw something like this. So the task is to essentially link these two states by special solutions so that we go along these special curves that we introduce. So this would be, for example, our curve, T1, this would be T2, and this would be T3. And so where they intersect, this is exactly where we introduce these intermediate states. So these would be these states here, Z1, Z2 in real space. I'll draw this in a second for the Euler equations. And so this has to be sufficiently close. So these UR and UL have to be sufficiently close to each other. So this is this local set D tilde that we introduced in the theorem last time. And we'll actually estimate, so Ramiro actually asked this really good question last time, whether we can actually estimate how far we can go for a solution to still exist. And so for the Euler equations, this is well known. And so we'll get to this actually toward the end of today's lecture. We'll actually estimate how big this region D tilde is for the Euler equations. And so in real space, the situation looks like this. So where our solution exists, our solution lives. So we have this linearly degenerate characteristic field lambda 2. And so we know this is a contact discontinuity. And so as I just mentioned a few minutes ago, so often this is called also an entropy wave in contrast to the sound waves, which essentially correspond to the other two nonlinear waves. And that's because, as I mentioned, this is associated with a jump in entropy. And so then we have the other two that might be either shock or rarefaction waves. So this is lambda 3, and this is, this is lambda 1. And so this is a 1 shock, and this could be a 3 shock. Or it could be a 1 rarefaction wave. Or this could also be a rarefaction wave. And then our data UR lives out here, and our data UL lives here. And so here in between, we have these intermediate states, Z1 and Z2. And actually, just for purpose of notation, I'll introduce here this region as the so-called star region. This is what this region is often sort of referred to in practice, if you look at papers or books. And so usually the states here are then denoted by star left and star right, so left and right of the rarefaction wave. And with W, I want to refer here to the set of primitive variables, because it will turn out that we can actually solve this problem fairly easily if we sort of discuss, if we sort of look at primitive variables instead of conservative variables. And that has to do with the fact that some of the Riemann invariants are actually invariant in the star region, so they don't change across the rarefaction wave. And so that actually reduces the number of unknowns of the problem and gives rise to an easy strategy to solve this problem in for a given initial data UL and UR. And we'll see how this actually works is something we'll see in a second. So let me just write this down real quick. So we know, so our set of primitives, right? So W, we could write down a formulation of the Euler equation in terms of primitives, in terms of the following primitives, namely the density, the velocity, and the pressure. And so now you can see why it's actually why this problem is actually simplified going to the primitive variables, because as you can see here, U and P, two of these primitive variables, are actually constant across the rarefaction wave because they are two Riemann invariants, and so they stay constant. So we can just simply refer to U star and P star rather than sort of U star left and U star right and P star left and P star right. So this is essentially the idea. So that is why it turns out to be easier to work with these primitive variables in this case. And as I said, we'll stick to a primitive formulation of the Euler equations with these set of primitives. Okay, and so as I mentioned also last time, and as I just mentioned, so there's various possibilities here, right, for the solution. So we know that the solution has to be essentially of this type, but the only thing that's really fixed is this contact discontinuity. And so we still have choices to make for lambda one and lambda three. So this gives rise to essentially four cases. And so I'll just sketch them here again because we'll need to refer to them in the following. So we can have those cases where we have a rarefaction wave associated with lambda one. And then we might either have a shock wave to the right, or we have actually a two rarefaction wave solution. Or we may have a shock to the left. Then again, a contact discontinuity. And then either a right rarefaction wave or a two shock solution. And so this will be one, will be two, this will be three, and so this will be four. And so maybe just as a quick aside, as a little bit of motivation, some sort of astrophysical background to this. So this is just essentially the general patterns of the solution to the Riemann problem. And one might argue that obviously that problem is sort of a very idealized problem and may not be of practical use. As I already mentioned last time, it will be of practical use for the general case, for a general solution to the Euler equations, because essentially all the numerical methods will make use of that as an integral part of the algorithm. But even just this idealized solution of the Riemann problem actually does play a role in practice. It is essentially everywhere in astrophysics. You'll find that Riemann problem and such wave solutions essentially associated with many astrophysical systems. And so I just wanted to point out two quick cases where, you know, knowledge of this general solution of the Euler equations of to the Riemann problem are actually quite useful and important. And so this is just a quick aside, essentially. So one system where this actually plays an important role are supernova explosions. So where you have a collapsing star at the end of its life, it collapses onto itself. The sort of implosion is sort of converted into an explosion by mechanisms that are still sort of investigated and to some degree still unknown. But essentially the idea is that you have sort of some explosion that reverses, that causes essentially a shockwave to run, essentially circular, spherical shockwave to run into the interstellar medium. And by the time that this ejector material essentially, so on this ISM has some density, rho zero maybe, and by the time that this shockwave has essentially swept up enough material that the total swept up material equals roughly its own mass associated with that shockwave, then you essentially get a hydrodynamical problem where out here you'll have a shockwave forming. So this blast wave essentially transforms into a shockwave where you essentially get a Riemann problem. And so at this, what you'll have here essentially will then be something as indicated here, where you have a state to the right, which is determined by the ISM, so the interstellar medium that has some density, essentially zero velocity compared to the shockwave, and also very low pressure. And then you have essentially the state on the left that has the swept up material and the supernova ejector itself. And so at this boundary, then all of a sudden you have this Riemann problem, and the system will then evolve into one of these general solutions. And the typical one that you'll find realized in such a system is essentially this solution four here, a two shock solution. So what you'll find then is that you'll have this so-called forward shock. And then you'll get a contact discontinuity. Oops. And then you get a reverse shock. And they start to spread. So the forward shock obviously will further travel into the interstellar medium. And the reverse shock will actually, at some point, depending on when and how the shockwave slows down, will actually try to recede and sort of move actually back toward the interior to the star, and partially reshock some of the material that's behind the shock front. And you can actually see this. The structure with astronomical.
Sorry, Daniel. What you said. Sorry, Daniel. What you said last, yes, about the reverse shock got. I don't know about the other people, but for me, got completely cut out, so I didn't hear what you said.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Thank you. my internet connection may be a bit unstable. So I don't know exactly where you guys lost me, but so I was mentioning that so once the shockwave essentially has swept up enough material that it becomes comparable to its own mass, the wave will sort of, this blast wave, so this sort of free expansion of material will actually become a hydrodynamic problem, and will shock the ISM. You will have typically you'll then be in this case four, where you will have a forward shock. So the original blast wave front will separate into different waves according to the general Riemann problem. You'll have a forward shock. You will have a contact discontinuity in between, and then you will have a reverse shock. And so the velocity of this reverse shock at some point might be sort of fast enough that it can overtake the overall expansion or the initial expansion of the blast wave, and so recede to the interior and partially reshock some of the material that's left behind the supernova, this original supernova blast wave. And so this is what's called a supernova remnant. And you can actually observe these structures, and you can essentially, to some degree, directly see the solution of the Riemann problem by astronomical observations. You'll actually see emission coming from the forward shock in terms of radio emission, and sometimes here in the interior, where in the supernova remnant, you can actually see synchrotron. Also synchrotron emission. So this is again radio emission that is emitted from electrons that gyrate in magnetic field structures in the interior. And sometimes you can also directly see emission from this reverse shock, for example. So this is actually very interesting, where you can directly see essentially the solution to a Riemann problem being sort of realized in nature. The second system that I just wanted to quickly highlight is another typical system that's sort of great interest in astrophysics, which is jets. So astrophysical jets are essentially on all scales. In AGNs, in active galactic nuclei, active galaxies, you'll have them in gamma ray bursts especially, and they may be of the long or short nature, so you can have systems like collapsars, collapsing stars that produce long gamma ray bursts, or neutron star mergers where you would produce short gamma ray bursts. And also here, the basic model idea to explain the high energy non-thermal emission is exactly, again, a Riemann problem. So you have some source at the center, what usually astronomers call a central engine. And that, so for example, if we focus now on the on the gamma ray burst case, that would be either a collapsing star, so a black hole that is accreting material, or in the short case, you would have a neutron star merger that again leads to the formation of a black hole that again accretes mass and gives rise to a jet-like outflow. So let's call this a jet, so a collimated, in this case, highly relativistic outflow of material. And then again, as this jet travels far enough into the interstellar medium, such that the sort of free expansion of that jet is slowed down by the mass, by sweeping up the mass of the ISM, it slows down and becomes a typical hydrodynamical problem in the very same way as for our supernova case. And typically this jet then also widens up. And so again, here we get the same structure where the initial blast wave then transforms into a forward shock. And then again, we have a contact discontinuity forming, and then we have also a reverse shock. And So as some of you may know, gamma ray bursts are these intense flashes of gamma rays. The gamma rays themselves are actually thought to be created inside the jet by also processes that are still to be understood in more detail. But typically, if you look at emission that is recorded from these systems, you get this initial sort of spike of gamma rays, but then and that may last in the case of short bursts only a second or two at most, but then it would have this long lasting, at least for some systems, it would have a long lasting afterglow. I won't get into too much detail, but the sort of canonical case is actually where you get some power law afterglow in the X-rays. So that goes like T to the minus alpha or so. And so this is X-ray emission. So if this is essentially luminosity versus time, and it's thought that exactly this forward shock of this Riemann problem generates these X-rays and leads to such a power law afterglow of gamma ray bursts. So again, this is one system where such a Riemann problem is specifically realized. Any questions so far? Okay, if not, then I would continue and discuss how to solve the Riemann problem for the Euler equations, given some arbitrary initial data. And so the idea is that we need to find out in a concrete, for given UL and UR, essentially we need to figure out in which of these four cases we actually are, and then write down the solution in real space. So some solution U of X comma T. So this will be our task. And so essentially we'll do this in a two-step way that will then sort of iterate on itself. We'll first assume that we actually know the set of primitives in this star region. So we'll assume that we know the state here, and then make inferences about what sort of this left and what this the right wave would be for a given set of primitives in this region. And then we'll iterate essentially on this. We'll then assume that, okay, this was only some initial guess, and we'll then make an iterating scheme on this where we'll refine our estimate for the primitives in this region. And in this way, by iterating, actually converge to the actual solution of the problem. So let me just write down this idea. So we'll assume we actually know U star and P star in a star region, so which are again constant across the contact discontinuity. And then we'll see which of these cases actually applies. And we'll write down, we'll then explicitly construct the combined solution for the in real space. And then assuming that this was only an initial guess, which should be reasonable, of course, we seek to find an iterative scheme to determine U star and P star from which the final solution will follow with step one. So let's do this. So let's start with step one and assume that U star and P star are actually given. So we'll treat regions left and right of the contact discontinuity separately. So focusing here on the left side for now. So let's say that say this is again our real space. We have our contact discontinuity somewhere. So this would be x over t equal to u star, which is the wave of the contact, so the wave speed, the zero wave speed essentially of the contact discontinuity. And here, let's say we have the characteristic speed associated with the first wave. And so we have our initial data here now expressed in terms of the primitives W. And then here we'll have a set of primitives that we'll call W star left. And here we'll have the set of primitives that we'll refer to as W star right. So as I said, let's focus on the left side. So where, so all points where x over t is smaller equal than u star, which is exactly this line here. Okay. Now, if we now obviously have to distinguish between two cases, if P star is greater than P left, then one can actually show that this corresponds to compressive data. And so we'll be in the case of a left shock. So you can convince yourself of this by essentially evaluating sort of lambda of UL, which is actually faster here than lambda of U star. which is lower, so we'll get the contractive data. So we'll be in the situation 2 or 4, so where we have a shock to the left. So we can immediately write down from the analysis that we've done in the previous chapter that the shock solution will look like this in real space, where we have the unshocked data, so the original data here, if x over t is smaller than the shock speed being determined by the Rankine-Gugnaud conditions, and we'll have W left shock if, which is still to be determined, if we're on the right side of the shock front. And so this is given by this constant state where we almost know everything by construction. So we know U star and P star. The only unknown really is the density. But this we can actually get from the jump conditions, because we know that the shock obviously needs to satisfy the Rankine-Gugnaud jump conditions. And you'll actually show on the current problem set that the Rankine-Gugnaud jump conditions for the Euler equations provide the following formula, where we can express everything in terms of the pressure on the right side and all other quantities on the left side. So everything is known. So this would be P star over PL plus gamma minus 1 over gamma plus 1, so where gamma is the adiabatic index of our ideal gas equational state. So this is essentially the expression that you'll derive on the problem set. And also the other unknown in the solution is the shock speed. And that again also is determined by the Rankine-Gugnaud jump conditions, which are also derived on the problem set. This is UL minus, and then the sound speed CL on the left. And then we have square root of gamma plus 1 over 2 gamma PL plus gamma minus 1 over 2 gamma. So fairly simple expressions. And with that, so with these jump conditions, we have the solution completely determined. Now, the other case is where the pressure is smaller or equal to PL. And so in this case, you can convince yourself that the characteristic speeds, so lambda on the left is actually smaller than lambda on the right, and so, or say star in this case, and so you have expansive data, and so then this being a genuinely nonlinear field, it must be a rarefaction wave. So this would give rise to a left rarefaction wave. So we are in case 1 or 3. And so the situation would be the following. So again, if this is our contact discontinuity, and then we'll have a tail and a head of the rarefaction wave. So this is where x over t equals the tail speed on the left. So this is the tail. This is the head, actually, x over t. This is the head speed. And then in here, we have this fan solution that continuously connects the tail and the head. So this will be, we'll call this WL fan. Here we have W star left, and here we have W star right. And here's again our initial data WL. And so also again from the previous section, from the previous chapter, we know that the solution in real space will look like the following. So we'll have our initial data where x over t is smaller than the head speed. And then we'll have the fan solution between the head and the tail. And then we'll have the star solution that is specified except for the density to the right of the rarefaction solution. So this will be x over t greater than the tail speed. And so again, we need to find a few unknowns here. So star L will be so these are again known, and the only unknown here is the density. And then the other part of the solution that we will still need to construct also is the fan part, which is the so state inside rarefaction wave. And so this can be now done using the Riemann invariant. So they will actually help us construct this. So we need to find rho star L. We need to find the tail and the head speed. And we need to find the structure of the fan solution. And we'll do this by noting that we have two, one Riemann invariants that stay constant across this rarefaction wave. And so if you remember from the beginning what I showed there, these are the two one Riemann invariants. So it's a specific entropy and then this combination of the fluid velocity plus 2 times the sound speed over gamma minus 1. So since we know that the specific entropy is constant across the whole structure, we can actually use the sort of isentropic corner case of the ideal gas equation of state. And with that, actually determine the density U star L. So we know that then the pressure must be related to the density just in this polytropic fashion across the whole wave structure, where this gamma up here is the adiabatic index. Of our ideal gas equation of state. So that's known. So we know that across, and we can determine the polytropic constant in the following way. So across the wave, we know that this law must hold. So we get the polytropic constant as K as P left over rho left to the power of gamma. And so we can write down immediately the density on the left as density on the star left as density on the left. And then P star over PL to the power of one over gamma. So this specifies one of the unknowns in terms of all other known quantities. And in order to get the head and tail speeds, we need to know the sound speed. And so this can be now also easily obtained using the expression for the sound speed and the second one Riemann invariant. So remember the sound speed here is square root of gamma and then P over rho. And so using the expressions for P star and rho star that we just computed, we then find an expression for the sound speed on the right to the rarefaction wave. So this is given by the sound speed on the left. And then just doing a little bit of algebra here, you'll find this relation, gamma minus one over two gamma. So it specifies the sound speed to the right of the rarefaction wave. And with this, we can easily compute the head and tail speeds, because now we just need to plug this into the expression for our wave speed. So the head speed will be given by lambda one evaluated on the state on the state on the left. And so here UL is really refers to the set of conserved variables on the left. And so this is a little confusing notation here, because I'm using U both to indicate the fluid velocity, but also the set of primitive, but also the set of conserved variables. So it depends here on the context. I apologize for this confusion. This could be done better. And so the same will get the tail speed, which will be given by the characteristic speed evaluated in the star region. And so we just computed those values. So U star is given. And then we just need to subtract the sound speed, C star left, that we just computed. And so this part of the problem is also solved. So we got rho star left, we got the two bounding wave speeds, the tail and the head. And so now let's write down what the fan part here is. So here again, we'll make use of the Riemann invariants. So they prove to be extremely useful. in constructing the solution. So we have our head and our tail. And so now we'll focus on some characteristic in here that passes through some point x, t. And so we know here that the solution is actually constant on these characteristics. So that was one of the defining properties of rarefaction wave. And so the slope of this characteristic here is x over t, and this is given by our eigenvalue, so by the signal speed here, which, as we know, is u minus the sound speed. So this is one condition that we have. And then the other condition is given by the Riemann invariant, namely we know that this Riemann invariant needs to stay constant across the wave. So we have now two equations. So this equation and this equation for two unknowns, namely u and c. And so we can use some algebra, combine these two equations. And finally find the structure in the fan. And this is given by rho, u, and p, and they can be re-expressed in terms of known quantities. We'll have your rho L, and then we find actually these expressions here, CL. Here we have UL minus X over T. And then here we have exponent 2 over gamma minus 1. So I'm going through this in great detail here because I actually would like you to implement this into an algorithm and actually write what is often called an exact Riemann solver. Because essentially the solution can be at least in iterative steps can be actually written down in this exact fashion. And then I'd like you to use that Riemann solver essentially and explore a few problems. So this will be the next problem set. And it actually turns out to be much simpler and easier to implement this than it might seem from going through these sort of long derivations. And so here we have the same exponent 2. No, actually 2 gamma over gamma minus 1. Okay, and this now concludes essentially our quest for the rarefaction wave solution to the left. Now, in sort of very analogous terms, you can You can now do the same thing and treat the right-hand side in a similar way. So the right side of the contact is continuity. So this would be essentially step two, and everything will be very analogous. I won't go through the details here because everything is really analogous. So we are now to the right side of the contact discontinuity. Analogous to the above. So again, if P star would be greater than P right, so now we are in this section where we're concentrating on this lambda 3 eigenvalue on this front. Again, one can show here that if P star is greater than PR, this will give rise to a shock. So we are in 1 or 4 of the 4 general cases. You can write down a set of primitives in this way. Again, you have same structure as before. And so again, you use the Rankine-Ugel-Neo conditions to find the density the shock speed SR. So you get exactly analogous, even identical expressions than in the previous case for the left. And the same thing applies to the case where we have expansive data, which gives rise to a rarefaction wave. So this would be either cases 2 or 3. And the solution will be of the same type. Where we have so this is W star right, left to the rarefaction wave. Then we have the intermediate fan part. We are between the tail and the head speed. And we have our initial data to the right of the rarefaction wave. And again, here, all the unknowns are determined in the same way as we just explored for the left side. And you get almost identical expressions, except for a few minor signs that flip because the wave speed is different. So here, lambda 3 is u plus the plus c, so plus the sound speed, and so this causes a few minor signs, a few changes here, but the expressions are entirely analogous. Okay, so this is essentially the idea of how you determine the nature of the 1 and the 3 wave, given some intermediate state u star and p star. And now we want to, and we've actually written down the exact solution to this in real space. And so now the second task is to actually find what the state in the middle is. So what that star state actually is. And so this was our second step. But maybe before I start this, I just wanted to ask if if there are any questions so far on this. So everything is essentially very straightforward up to here. And also the rest will be sort of fairly straightforward. It is just sort of making clever use of a few constraints and a few properties that we know of, such as the jump conditions, the Riemann invariants, to determine the nature of the solution. And all the sort of algebraic manipulations are also fairly fairly simple. So the idea how to do this is actually to formulate it as a root finding problem. And this is usually how this is being done in actual Riemann solvers. And so the statement is the following, that we can actually obtain U star and P star as the solution to the following root finding problem. And we'll decouple this actually in two individual problems. So, yes?
Could you maybe repeat the last sentence? It was really broken off for me at least.
Okay. Okay, I'll try again. So the idea here is to formulate this as a root finding problem. So this is usually the way that it's formulated in practical applications where you actually write a Riemann solver. So we'll obtain U star and P star, so this pair that entirely defines sort of this initial state in terms of our approach to the solution. We'll find those as the root of a root finding function that I'm going to define here. And we'll split this actually in two parts. So first we'll actually find a solution for P star. And then, so it seems that we can actually separate the two variables in some sense and first compute P star. And knowing that we can then compute U star. So the idea here is the statement is the following, that we can obtain P star as the root of the following function. Assuming again an ideal gas equation of state. So for non-ideal gases, becomes a little more complicated, but the idea will still be the same. So we'll write down a function which we'll define as the sum of a few terms here, a function that depends on the pressure in the left state, and a function that depends on the pressure and on the right state. And then we also have, add the speeds on the right and subtract the speed on the left. So where these terms are given by the following expressions. So if P is greater than P left, so we're having a shock on the left side, and then we have P over P left gamma minus 1 over 2 gamma if we have a rarefaction wave. And then we have a similar expression for the right side. Excuse me, this is WR. Okay, so these are essentially the general terms, and there are some constants that we still need to specify. So this is just some combinations here of known quantities. So this looks a little abstract here. But essentially what happens here is that we formulate the matching conditions between the corresponding special curves. So the either a shock set and a rarefaction wave, or two shock sets or two rarefaction waves in primitive space. So this is essentially essentially transforming these special curves into primitive space, knowing that the intermediate state will be a contact discontinuity. And then you specify essentially the general functions for a shock set and a rarefaction wave associated with the left and the right state in primitive state, and you try to match them. And this matching condition gives rise to this sort of nonlinear function here. And the solution will be exactly the zero, the root of this function. So if you want to think in terms of this state space transformed into the space of primitives, this is essentially what happens here sort of behind the scenes. But you can sort of derive all of this just sort of purely in a purely algebraic way, ignoring sort of this geometric interpretation behind it. But I like to think more in terms of this sort of geometric interpretation, and this is essentially what's happening here. And so once we found. So once we match these different curves in state space of our primitives, so found the correct pressure that would actually do this, then we can immediately write down the velocity in terms of known quantities. In this way. So maybe in the interest of time, I will skip the derivation here. I'm not sure how useful it would be to go through this here in detail. It's essentially algebraic manipulations using, again, sort of known properties like the jump conditions, and just rewriting these jump conditions in a clever way, or in the case of rarefaction waves, sort of write down, again, the Riemann invariants and make clever use of the Riemann invariants to show essentially to show that this intermediate state has to be a root of this function. So I encourage you to take a look at that derivation, which is in the notes in great detail. So you can go through this. It's not extremely long, but in the interest of time, I'll skip it now because I really want to start with the conservative schemes on Tuesday. But instead, in the last sort of 10 to 12 minutes, rather discuss a few properties of this root finding problem, because there are a few things that one can illustrate here. So essentially, if we now assume that we can determine this intermediate state U star and P star by formulating some matching conditions for these special curves in state space, and find that state as the root of such a function. Let's make a few conclusions about how we can see the different solutions depending on the behavior of the function. So there's a few things one can show. And again, the details are not not that important. I just want to sort of highlight a few conclusions here, that the derivative is always greater than zero, which means that the function is monotonically increasing. And also one can show that the second derivative of this matching condition is smaller than zero, which means it's a concave function. And one can also show, and so you can convince yourself by just really explicitly computing these derivatives. This is just a little bit tedious, but in principle, trivial. The expressions are not too complicated. And so you can show that also that both the first and the second derivative actually approach zero as you go to infinite pressure. So we can essentially get a basic idea of this function by just looking at these few facts. So let's say our function looks like this for some delta u, which is this second part here of the function. Should highlight this up here. Where are we here? So depending on what the difference between the velocities on the right and the left is, so this sort of offsets the other two terms. And so there can be now sort of different scenarios according to what this difference is. So let's say this for some UR and UL we find this this curve in this way, then the root of this here will correspond to our P star that we want to find. And we might have some other cases. So let's say, like this, and something like this. Okay, then let's say this is P min. I'll define this in a second. And this is P max. Then here would get F max. And this would be then F min. Okay, and this root finding problem will be then defined in this way. So P min is just the minimum pressure among the left and the right state. And then F min is the corresponding value of the function. P right. And then we have F max here, which is F of P max. So this will correspond to a different delta U. Say this is like a, okay, let me call this then delta U1. This delta U2. And so there are three different regimes essentially, which I wanted to highlight here. Let's name this the interval I1. And then from here, to here, we have our interval I2. And then out here, we have I3. So we can now distinguish the three regimes. And those will correspond to the different cases for our general solution. So if both are, if F min and F max are both greater than zero, then P star, the root has to be in I1. And so this would correspond to the blue curve. So this would be essentially this blue case. And then if F min is smaller or equal to zero and F max is greater or equal to zero, then P star is in I2. So this would correspond to the state that I labeled here with two. So in the case of the black curve. And then finally we have the third case where F min and F max are smaller than zero both, and then we're in I3. And so the interpretation here is that according to these, just checking these function values, we can now infer what kind of solution we're looking at. So in I1, P star is then smaller than P left and P right, which means that we have two rarefaction waves. So so both lambda 1 and lambda 3 would then correspond to a rarefaction wave. If we are in the following situation where p star is in I2, we have two possibilities. Either we have the first or the second ordering here of pressure values. So we would have one rarefaction wave . So this would be a case where we have one rarefaction wave and one shock solution. And then finally, if we're in this case I3, where P star is then greater than both P left and P right, as you remember, those would then give rise to shocks. So we have actually a two shock solution. Okay, and so actually from this behavior of the function, we can immediately derive actually the limit to the existence of a solution to the Riemann problem. And this brings me to, this brings me to discussing the vacuum condition. So as I mentioned earlier, we want to know sort of how far can UR and U left, so the two states of the Riemann problem, be separated from each other for the Lux theorem still to provide a solution. And so this is something we can directly see from this function. And so because we know that the pressure has to be positive for it to be a physical solution. And so we need to, so for a solution to exist, we need to, since it's monotonically increasing, so this function is monotonically increasing, for a zero, so for a root to exist, f of zero has to be f of zero or close to zero has to be smaller than zero. So there's this monotonicity property. Now the critical point is essentially where this function, let me choose a different color here. So the critical case would be where this function is exactly like this, where, so this would be P star critical, where the zero of this, where the root of this function is exactly at zero pressure. And so from looking at the function in this case, we can get a condition on the existence of a solution to the Riemann problem. So this will be the very last thing I'll write down. So we'll be finishing on time in just a minute. So this will be in this case where we have left and right rarefaction waves. And this makes intuitive sense because in that case, we would have two rarefaction waves that sort of rarefy the interior part so much that it would actually create vacuum. It would actually give rise to vacuum. And so we can directly compute when this vacuum would be produced. Namely, when the difference in UR and UL is given by the following form. So f of p star critical would be zero in this case. So that would be zero pressure. And then we would just need to evaluate the function at zero. So f left of zero and f right of zero. And just plugging in the expressions that I mentioned above, we get a fairly simple criterion here, fairly simple expression. So this is, let me just write this down in a simpler way. So this would be just 2 over gamma minus 1. And then we have the sound speed on the left plus the sound speed on the right. And so this is exactly defining sort of the critical difference here between the left and the right state of the Riemann problem for a solution to still exist. And so if you would feed initial data that has a difference here that is bigger than this critical difference, then vacuum would be created and the Riemann solver would essentially just crash and not find a solution. So this is, in other words, a concrete estimation of this smallness constraint in the Lux theorem. If I just scroll up here, of this region d tilde here, that we were able now to specify essentially in the case of the Euler equations. Okay,